I've called this first sermon, Surviving the Education System. When we begin Daniel, we are around the 6th century BC, just to orientate you. God's people live in Judah, which was the southern kingdom of the split kingdom, and Israel was called the northern kingdom. The temple is still standing, but politically Judah is a very minor state. It has no real power. Spiritually, they've fallen away from worshipping God, and prophetic voices that you see in the Old Testament keep warning the kings and the people that they are heading into trouble and that God is going to judge them for their apostasy. Israel, the northern kingdom, has already undergone this judgment and been destroyed, and it seems the same fate awaits Judah, the southern kingdom. Now, you might wonder, 6th century Jewish history, what sort of relevance does this have for me this morning? Is this just going to be an exercise in biblical history? Well, I think there is great profit for us in reading this book in the Old Testament for at least two reasons. First of all, it will show us how God's people are to live in a hostile world. Daniel ends up in Babylon, which throughout the Bible, all the way through to the last book of the Bible, is a symbol for everything that is opposed to God. We will see how a man of faith stands against such godlessness, how he maintains his faith, and even ends up in a position of influence. You and I live in a largely godless secular culture, and often we feel morally and spiritually compromised. It's not easy to know exactly how to be God's people in the world that we confront. And we need all the help we can get to remain faithful Christians in our society and our workplaces and in our families. Daniel is a deeply practical book, therefore. Some even call it a book of wisdom. Secondly, and a connected reason, is that Daniel reminds us that even when things look bleak, God is still there and God is still at work. Every time something awful happens and is reported in our newspapers and on our various media, we are naturally forced to think about where is God in that mess? Where is God in our mess? Why doesn't God act a bit more obviously to make himself known? And subtly, we might begin to think, God is great when I come to church. God is hidden when I'm out in the world. But Daniel reminds us that God is in charge of the whole world. And as we'll see in the second half of Daniel, which we look at after Christmas, he's even in charge of the future of the world. So Daniel is a deeply theological book as well as a deeply practical book. So let's look at chapter 1 together. If you'd like to bring up the text again, Liz, please, that would be great. Verses 1 and 2 I've entitled, God Hands His People to the Enemy. The dating of Daniel is incredibly complex and contentious, but I'm not going to go into that. Let me just simply remind you that we're in the 6th century, at least that's when these first incidents occur. The beginning and end of this first chapter of Daniel give us some idea of his dates. The third year of Jehoiakim, verse 1, when he's the king of Judah, to verse 21, the king of Persia, who is King Cyrus. In our calendars, that would roughly be about 605 to 539 BC. As the chapter opens, the Babylonians are flexing their muscles under their new leader, Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar's forces are on the march throughout the Middle East, winning battles, taking prisoners, and building empire. You can see a little map of that on the front of Contact as to where Babylon is in reference to Judah and a couple of other places. Now, in the midst of this expansionist program, Nebuchadnezzar takes control of this little city called Jerusalem. And we'll see as he leaves to go home, he takes two things with him. Firstly, he takes people, he takes prisoners, especially members of the royal family. And this deliberately weakens the local leadership and reduces the likelihood of further rebellion once he's left. But secondly, he takes items from the Jewish temple. And when you read the first chapter of Ezra and see what they're given back to return to Jerusalem with, these items from the Jewish temple are quite extensive, gold and silver, goblets and bowls and all sorts of things. But what Nebuchadnezzar is doing there is he's not interested in these things just for their financial value. What he's saying there is, not only have I defeated you militarily, but my God is stronger than your God. Your God is weak. I'm taking all your stuff out of your holy place and I'm going to put it in my holy place. See how that works? So he's going to leave these people absolutely crushed spiritually. So although Daniel opens with a defeat, we should take note that God has not been defeated. Please look at verse 2. It says here, the Lord, that's God, Yahweh, the Lord, delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. So what is happening here is not God's defeat, but is part of God's mysterious plan. It may look like God's people have just been routed. It may look like God has just been defeated. God's temple may look desecrated, but God is still at work in the midst of this seeming darkness. Now, Daniel will raise for us a tension that is relevant to every age of God's people. That is, how do we live in a hostile world where it looks like God is weak, God is powerless? What do we do when powerful forces come against God's people? And one answer we get right at the outset is not to be deceived, not to be mistaken, that despite appearances, God is still at work. Let's move on to the assimilation program, verses 3 to 7. One of the best ways to build an empire, if you're interested in doing this, is to educate the elite young leaders. Fire their minds with the best of your culture. Let them have special privileges. Keep them close to you. Keep them near the center of power. Let them become used to how power is exercised. Perhaps they'll become intoxicated with that. After a while, they'll see how backward their own countries are and how much better a future they will have if they just sort of become a bit more like you. That will be in their better interests, and therefore they will stop wanting to rebel. Now, we might call this process that these young men are going to go through assimilation or education or leadership training, or you might just simply call it brainwashing, whatever word you want to use. But it is shrewd. These young men from Judah are among the cream of their society. They are from the royal and noble families. They are, verse 4, like many of your children. Look at this. They are without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand. Physically and intellectually, they are the top of the tree, like many of your children and grandchildren. They're probably in their late teens. Instead of chopping off their heads as a foreign threat, the king, in fact, gives them a three-year education in Babylonian studies and royal service. The aim is that they be immersed in the culture of their enemies, and which we can see from verses 4 and 20 will include language and literature, and then magic and the occult. This is not a values-free education. This is an education which is quite intentionally trying to influence the worldview of these young men to realise that the Babylonian way of thinking, of culture, of God, of theology, all of that, that is correct. That's the appropriate way for these young men to think. This is an assault on their very identity, and this is made clear when they're renamed. Each of their Jewish names, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, have in them references to Hebrew words for God. The word El, or the syllable El, is a word for God, and Yah is part of the syllable for Yahweh. Daniel, for example, means God, El, is my judge. And their names then will remind them of their heritage and will give them a little challenge to remain faithful, a little bit like my name, Peter, is an echo of an apostle in the New Testament. Their new names, Belshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, all have references in them to Babylonian gods. It's a none too subtle way of saying that these young men were now servants of other gods. Daniel's name includes the reference to the god Bel, for example. And the name change then tries to get inside these young men a change of identity. Even how they're introduced in the court will be a reminder that you have long since left your God, way back in Jerusalem. Forget him. He is not your protector anymore. And it would be a little bit like if I moved to the Middle East and instead of being called Peter, I was then given the name Abdullah. It would help to sort of give me a new identity and slowly and insidiously try and remove my Christian identity. While they undergo this forced re-education, one of the luxuries that they will have is food and wine from the king's table. It's a great luxury. But this is exactly where Daniel decides to draw the line. So let's move on to verses 8 to 16, which I've called Daniel Resists and God Acts to Protect His People. Verse 8, but Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine and asks for permission to be given vegetables and water. Now, what's the issue here? Is there something inherently wrong with eating meat and drinking wine? Well, all you Australians who like your Australian Shiraz and good steak are hoping the answer is no, aren't you? I think the answer is no. I think what Daniel is doing here is he is reasserting his faith in God. I think Daniel is drawing a line in the sand, spiritually speaking, for himself. It's as if he's saying, look, we've cooperated this far. We've agreed to learn your language and culture. We've allowed our names to be changed. We haven't tried to escape. We're being fairly polite and agreeable. We've agreed to all this assimilation, but enough is enough. If he just accepts everything the king gives him, then there will be no reason why he has to keep trusting his God. He will have all his needs met. There'll be nothing inside him that says, Daniel, remember God is in charge. So I think what he does is he chooses the food and wine as the way to assert his faith in God. There's nothing wrong with meat and wine per se, and in fact, in chapter 10, verse 3, it appears that Daniel has been eating meat and drinking wine. So the issue is not what he eats and drinks. The issue is he doesn't want to give in to all the temptations of the Babylonian court. He doesn't want to just accept everything that's literally put on a plate for him. He actually wants to have some sort of discipline in his life where he knows that I'm going to take a risk here. I'm actually going to refuse something that the king is offering in order for me to be reminded that I need to keep trusting God every single day, because you get fed every day. It's a great time to be reminded of God's grace to you. That's one of the reasons we say grace, isn't it? And I think it's similar to Jesus' rejection of Satan's temptations of food and of power in Luke chapter 4. For Daniel to accept all that King Nebuchadnezzar is offering would leave no area in his life where he was really trusting God. It's his line in the sand. But now let me just point out to you how Daniel goes about this. Because some of you, I think by personality, are more argumentative, more confrontational, more ready to stand up and make statements for Christ than others. Some of you are very quiet. Some of you wouldn't dream of drawing attention to yourself in terms of standing up for Jesus, perhaps. What does Daniel actually do here? Well, notice he's very careful in how he goes about his protest. He doesn't go on a hunger strike. He doesn't get up on the roof and draw attention to himself. He doesn't need the media to come and put his name on the front page of the papers. He is very careful and diplomatic. Let's look at what he does, because I think there's a principle in here that's very helpful. First, he speaks to the chief official, verse 8, Ashpenaz. And although Ashpenaz is sympathetic, he is afraid that the outcome would be that he, Ashpenaz, would have his head chopped off, verse 10. So that's Daniel's first plan. Get the chief official to agree to this change of diet. Chief official says, no, too risky. Plan A is blocked. Not to be deterred, he then speaks to the guard, the fellow who actually stands out and looks after them every day, and he comes up with plan B. And he says, let's just have a 10-day trial. And then feed us vegetables, give us water for 10 days, then look at what we look like, and we're in your hands. Do what you see is fit. And nobody else will probably know about this. So at the end of the 10 days, they can compare meat eaters with vegetable eaters. Now, you see what Daniel is doing here. First of all, at a human level, he's extremely wise. Plan A got blocked, so let's try plan B. Tries to compromise, tries to find another way round, not making any big song and dance about it. But secondly, he is taking a huge risk inside himself because he knows that if this doesn't work and he fronts up after 10 days and looks pretty ragged, his head will get chopped off and so will his mates and so will the guards probably. But at the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his friends look healthier than any of the others. So for the rest of the 3 years, they get what they wanted in the first place. Not only the food they wanted, but an opportunity every mealtime to remember that God has been providing for them. Not just food, but God has been providing the protection that made them look healthier than any of the other guys. And presumably the guard is very happy because the guard gets all the meat and the wine. Ashpenaz probably doesn't know, and Nebuchadnezzar doesn't know. Now, the issue for us is not that we all become vegetarian teetotalers, although I totally respect you if you are. The issue is, do we ever need to draw a line anywhere and say, enough is enough, I am not going to engage with this part of my culture because this is not honouring to God and doesn't do me any good spiritually. And there are many areas in life where you might have to take a stand, and it may be just quietly. Nobody else may know. You may just quietly go about doing something for God because it's something inside you. It may not even be something you need to draw attention to other Christians to. For example, you might decide not to shop on Sunday as a protest against how commercialised our culture has become, when we just don't even realise anymore that shopping is an all-day, all-week affair for some people. You may have to be diplomatic and try different things in order to make your stand. For example, since our recent federal election, we seem to be under pressure as a country to move in questionable moral directions in regard to euthanasia and same-sex relationships. Those are going to be complicated arguments, complicated issues, and some Christians will need to make a stand somehow. And how they negotiate that way through those complicated discussions will require great wisdom. So how many times and in how many ways might we have to make a stand? And what's the wise way of doing it in order to win rather than lose? Whatever your issue or issues, let Daniel's courage at least give you courage. Let's move on. Verses 17 to 21, God gives his people wisdom and understanding. At the end of their undergraduate course in Babylonian studies, Daniel and his friends top the class. Nebuchadnezzar gives them a job interview and concludes in verse 20 that in every matter of wisdom and understanding, they are better than all the other advisors he has. He are described as magicians and enchanters. So notice that the situation they're in is so spiritually dark that the king relies on magicians and enchanters to advise him. That's the sort of culture they're going into. The king, when he looks at these young men, probably thinks their outstanding results are as an outcome of his wonderful education system and his good food. But we are told to view things differently. We are told, yet again, it's God who's been at work. Note verse 17. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. There's a little entree to what the next few chapters of Daniel is going to include. The writer wants us to know that God has been at work through these 3 years, right in the heart of idolatrous, occult, corrupt, godless Babylon. God, the God of the Bible, has been quietly forming some new leaders and giving them the very spiritual gifts they are going to need to navigate their way through this dangerous culture that they now find themselves in. And the chapters that follow will show Daniel and his friends triumphing again and again over the false wisdom of the Babylonians. Due to God's protection, Daniel will outlast his conquerors, verse 21, and he'll live to the time when the Persian king Cyrus not only conquers the Babylonians, but also allows the Jews to return to Israel, as we see in Ezra and Nehemiah. The Daniel we meet here in chapter 1 is perhaps someone we would like to emulate. He's not afraid of death. He's not afraid of powerful people. He's not afraid of the godless world around him. He remains faithful to God even when the future is uncertain. The strength of faith allows him to engage with the Babylonian culture. He doesn't withdraw into some holy, safe ghetto isn't frightened of being polluted. Now, this is a big issue. This was raised 40 or 50 years ago in the Christian world about how Christians relate to the culture that we find ourselves in, by Reinhold Niebuhr. And we seem to have only a couple of options. One is we might keep all the culture at bay and say it's all evil, let's have nothing to do with it, the only good things are Christian things. It could be that we try and engage with the culture and bring God's perspective on things into the culture. And it might just depend a little bit on what gifting God has given you as to which direction you go. But notice that Daniel engages with his culture. He knows there are limits and that sometimes you do have to say no. But even here he shows he is wise by negotiating his way through danger, finding possibilities, offering compromise where necessary and possible, but not compromising on his faith. It's very important to note that, I think. Through hard work and divine endowment, he then ends up in a position of influence and authority. He's positioned in a godless situation as God's agent. Now, I wonder, as I come to a close, if this rings any bells for you in your life. At the broadest level, I think it may give us some hints on how to be Christians in secular Australia. It may help us as we think about the broader culture that we live in, thinking about how it seems bit by bit, death by a thousand cuts, they say, our culture becomes less and less Christian. It becomes more and more distanced from our Judeo-Christian heritage. How do we as Christians try and remind our culture that in fact God is alive, God is active, and the Lord Jesus is the Lord over all of our culture? How do we do that? We have to keep working at that. There are no easy answers. That's at the broadest level. What about your workplace? Do you work in a largely godless environment? Some of you probably do. What can Daniel teach you about being God's person in that place? Do you feel sometimes I'd rather leave here and go in and work in a more Christian environment? That would be a natural thing to feel, particularly when you've just taken a bit of a hit at work. But the Christian environment, the church where I work, is as likely to be as godless as your place sometimes. And it's as difficult to be a God person in that environment. I've just spent the last couple of days at Synod. That's a difficult place to be a God person. You have to continue to work hard and say your prayers and be diplomatic. I was thinking about this while I was at Synod. Peter, remain diplomatic. For those of you who are either at school or university or have children at school and university, notice that what we learn from Daniel here is how people are educated actually is likely to influence how they think. And the education world that our children and our tertiary students are growing up in is not one where the Christian worldview would be taken as a given. They're largely being educated in a worldview where God is absent. So that is a difficult area to try and help our children and our students remain strong Christians and respond to the type of worldview that is coming against them. And those of you who are professionals, it may be that your profession requires particular thinking in terms of how you remain a Christian accountant or medic or teacher or doctor or whatever it is, because there might be particular ethical issues that influence and affect your profession, and you would be a great person to then help other young Christians who are going into that profession as well. Jesus picks up this tension in John 17 when he says that we are in the world but not of the world. He then prays, though, that we not be taken out of the world, but that God would protect us from the evil one. If you feel at times that the world is totally corrupt, and I'm sure many of us feel that at times, it is understandable, but that is the world you are sent to. That's the world that Jesus came into. That's the world that we have to remain witnesses to Christ in. There isn't any other world. And if we just withdraw from that world, we are basically saying, and this is a theological statement, the world can go to hell. So you see, one of the things we can learn from Daniel, if we wrestle with this over the coming weeks, is how can we actually stand firm in a godless, even occult world, and try and be God's people in that. God wants us to go into this world as salt and light. He wants us to make disciples. He wants us to point others to Jesus. How you do that is food for your prayers, and you will need to ask God to help you to be wise as you go about it. One last thing. We're constantly forced, aren't we, as we live, to wonder where God is in the midst of all the evil and suffering that we see every day. At the outset of Daniel, his people are defeated, exiled, the temple is desecrated, and his people are then immersed in a godless, pagan, occult culture. Melbourne is not Babylon, but Melbourne is not exactly a godly, Christ-honouring place either, is it? But note throughout chapter 1 of Daniel that we are reminded that God is still at work. Verse 2, the Lord delivered Jehoiakim into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. Verse 8, God caused the official to show favour to Daniel. Verse 17, God gave the four young men knowledge and understanding. And although it doesn't say it explicitly, verse 21, God keeps Daniel alive while the Babylonian Empire crumbles. Despite how things look in our world today, tomorrow, or this week, God is still at work. Now, do you believe that? Do you actually really believe that? Because tomorrow morning, when you turn on the news, read the paper, open your internet, whatever it is, you're going to be confronted with a barrage of things that say, God is not there. The world is crazy. This is not a world that God is in charge of. That's what you're going to be hit with. And on Tuesday, the same thing's going to happen, isn't it? And every single day until we meet again next Sunday. But Daniel reminds us God is still there, and whatever darkness there is that surrounds us, whatever the moral questions are that trouble our minds, whatever godless place you have to go to this week, God is still there. Daniel believed that. I encourage you to believe that and ask God to help you be his person wherever he takes you this week and stay faithful to him. Draw a line if you have to, but do that wisely, so that you can be God's person and use whatever influence he gives you. Amen.